There are many different ways of looking at Buddhist practice, dividing it up in a sense. Classic one is to look at it as having two wings, wisdom and compassion. I'd like to divide it up or look at it from two different perspectives today that have to go closer, you know, to mindfulness practice. Maybe two sides of mindfulness practice. And the first side is mindfulness itself. And that's certainly emphasized a lot in our circles. And it's, you know, kind of the name of the game for people who practice mindfulness is to be mindful. And there's a lot of benefits to mindfulness. There's a lot of power that comes from it. There's a lot of protection that comes from it. There's a mindfulness itself is kind of refuge for people. It's something that provides tremendous, can provide tremendous joy. It can provide a sense of being at home. It can provide peace. It could give a lot of, understanding. Mindfulness has a lot of benefits, a lot that it does. And it's been said sometimes that everything you need to know about Buddhism can be known through your own powers of observation. And being carefully mindful. You don't have to read any books about Buddhism, just if you pay careful attention. But usually the books help because they show you better how to pay attention. The other side of the practice, or the aspect, it's so important that I kind of give it almost equal weight to mindfulness, is that of making choices. Starting to make wise choices about how we live our lives and just what we do. And it could be, occasionally someone will come to me and say, I've been practicing mindfulness for a while, and I've gotten mindful. You know, I've seemed to be here in the present moment pretty well, and, I don't seem to, now what? And, it's quite an accomplishment to really arrive well in the present moment. Probably some of you have tried it and have found it challenging occasionally. The mind has a very strong tendency to not be in the present moment, to not really be here in the lived moment, but rather to be in a conceptual moment, to be in the future moments, the planning and thinking and anticipating the future, or in past moments, rehearsing them and reviewing them or improving on them. In many ways in which we relate to the past, or sometimes we're in fantasy. And the mind has a very strong tendency to kind of get off the present moment. And it's really beautiful to kind of arrive in the present moment. But part of the purpose of really arriving in the present, being mindful, being here carefully in the present moment, is to discover the place, the locus, of where we have choice. And if you don't see that you have choice in a situation, then you, in a sense you don't have any choice. And the more mindful you are, the more calm the mind is, the more choice you can actually see. A calm mind is a mind that sees a lot of things that an agitated mind cannot. Suzuki Roshi once said that if you want to see virtue in people, have a calm mind. It's been said that in the tradition, that in the Buddhist tradition, I think, if the mind is pure, all things are pure. If you kind of get yourself mindful and calm and centered, then you see things you can't see if you're agitated. And so the emphasis tonight is that you can see the place where you can make choices. And the choices you make are consequential. They're important. Occasionally, there are people who have kind of a naive Taoist kind of attitude about Buddhist practice, that it's just kind of to be in the present moment and then just go with the flow. And, there's no self, there's no choices, there's no intentions. Something just kind of operates through us and we just kind of ride the wonderful wave and we just know we know what to do. There's no real choice, it just kind of comes out of us and it's all really great. And that's nice if it happens that way. But I would argue that in the teachings of the Buddha, he put a tremendous emphasis on developing our capacity to choose wisely. And to think of it kind of like a muscle that can get weak, or you can build up and become strong. And you find yourself in some situations and you see that you have a choice to go one direction or the other. And you have the strength to be able to choose the wise way. To go and stand in front of the ice cream parlor and see that you have a choice there and choose the choice that's wise for you. Some people I know don't have a choice. They just start walking down the street with ice cream in their hand. And how'd that happen? Or you have a conversation with someone you're close to. How'd that happen that I said that? Wow, and afterwards you say, I wish I had seen where the choice was, because I really blew it in what I said. But if you're calm enough in a conversation, you'll see ahead of time, oh, here's, I have a choice of whether to tell my friend he's a jerk. And it's wise to see that moment of choice. And you're harried with a harried life and difficult life and all these things. Sometimes it's, we don't want to take the time to see the choice. We'd rather be Taoist. We'd rather just let it spurt out of us. Good, lousy. So to be in the present moment, to be calm in the present moment, gives us a lot of power, because in many ways, but one of the powers shows us where the choice is. And then it's important to start exercising it for a number of reasons. One reason is that we can exercise it and make wiser choices, and those wiser choices can lead to a better life. The other reason is that as we exercise our choice, we strengthen that muscle. It becomes a strength. We develop a strength. And so you go into more and more difficult situations and you carry that strength with you. You enter a situation that's very tempting and you have the strength to say, oh, I don't think I need to do that. No, thank you. Or this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to do this, X, Y, and Z. As we're mindful of the place of choice, we can also start seeing some of the things that influence the choices we normally make. And that's very fascinating and very important to see what makes us tick. So, for example, for a long time, when I was in the monastery, then monastery, I got to see very carefully, very well, and very painfully how much I wanted to be liked by people. And that I was making choices about the things I said, how I did, what I did, based on my hope that what I did would influence people to like me. Now, it's okay to be liked. There's nothing wrong with that. But you can be neurotic about that. And I was. And so I got to see it kind of in my face because I got calm enough and got enough, for various reasons I could see it. And then I could see, oh, when I saw it, then I started having a choice about it. If I didn't see it and it was operating kind of subconsciously, there was no choice. But as I got calm enough and quiet enough and centered enough in the present, I could see the places of choice. And it became kind of a tug for me, kind of difficult. I could see it, but it was so, it was so important to get people to like me. I mean, what's going to happen if they don't? I mean, they might not like me. And, that'd be terrible and they'll reject me and I'll have to leave or I'll die or some dire thing will happen. I wasn't quite sure what was going to happen. But I could feel my fear, my anxiety, my concerns, my projections, my fantasies about the future, what it would mean if people didn't like me. And that would come and, I'd feel the struggle as I was trying to find my way to have a wise choice. And I could see, oh, I don't really need to have this. It doesn't feel good to be carry with me this sense of wanting to be liked. What if I try not doing it? What if I let go of it? And so it was kind of a struggle with that. Oh, what do I do here? Do I let go of it? Do I not? Do I live a different way? Do I let people think that I'm a jerk? And I learned in the monastery sometimes, at one point I learned that when I was managing the kitchen actually functioned a lot better if I wasn't so concerned about people liking me. But if I tried to get everybody to like me in the kitchen, I had to tie myself in knots, to please everybody. So just sort of exercising the choice and facing up to some of the reasons why it's difficult to make wise choices, to really understand that. Today I was looking at some words by Suzuki Roshi, and he said, there's no wrong. There's only deepening your understanding. Sometimes our understanding is not very deep. And my job is when I see that your understanding is not very deep, or it's one-sided, then my job is to help make help point you to a deeper understanding. But there's no wrong. That was great. You're not wrong, but maybe your understanding is not so deep. And so how do you get to a deeper understanding? How do you get more deeply into the present moment? You can see, you know, what's really going on there and what is wise about making the choices you have to do. We're making choices all the time anyway. I mean, we're making choices every second, all the time. And if you have an itch and you choose to, you know, scratch your cheek, that's a choice that you make. But we don't think about that because we're not paying attention so carefully. We think that's kind of automatic. But there's always these little choices that are going on. And what practice wants to do is to highlight partly the choices you're always making so that you can see there are other choices that you want to make. When I came back from the Zen monastery after living there almost 3 years, there, in some ways, there were a lot of choices made for us. Much of our day was choreographed, how you stood, how you sat, how you ate, how you chanted, you know, all kinds of things, we kind of what you did with your body. And when I left the monastery, I'm back into kind of regular life. Life wasn't so choreographed in the same way as it was in the monastery. And because it wasn't, coming from the monastery, I was became much more consciously aware of all these choices I had to make now on my own. And something as simple and innocent as how I sit in a chair, I realized after being 3 years in the monastery, was a choice. Before going to the monastery, it never occurred to me I had a choice in how I sat in a chair. I just sat. When you sit, they say in Zen, right? When you eat, you eat. But that was kind of naive, because I would just sit without thinking about it. But after the monastery, I saw I could slump, I could sit up straight, I could sit different ways, and that there was a little bit of consequence depending how I sat. My energy changed, my presence changed, certain kinds of ways of sitting had different consequences in other ways, and I could start choosing about that. Now, some people hearing this are irritated, because to imply that spiritual practice involves taking responsibility for your choices is a drag. I mean, isn't it better? You could have a spirituality that was just all about radical, total, you know, acceptance by the universe of you, and you're just completely fine and wonderful, and you can just rest, and that's it. Wouldn't that be great? And for some people, mindfulness has that quality. It's really wonderful that sometimes mindfulness itself has this non-judgmental quality to it. So to kind of rest in a kind of awareness of yourself as non-judgmental can be very healing for people and very helpful. But there are choices we make all the time. So part of Dharma practice is to look at those, understand them, and then see, is there wiser ways that we can exercise those choices? Partly I thought about talking about this because I was in Vancouver this weekend, and there was a kind of a store that I drove by a couple of times that was kind of like maybe like a Whole Foods kind of store. And the name of the store was Choices. And I thought that was kind of an odd, a little bit odd in my ear, because, you know, you go into some of these stores in America, you know, around it, there's so many choices. I mean, they have cartoons, right? But you go into a store and you ask for X and say, do you want it with A and B, or do you want it the big size or the small size, or do you want it, you know? And you have to make all these choices because you can't just, you know, go and grab, you know, a bar of soap. There's all these different choices you have to make between the different bars. And then you have different people in your family, and they need, you know, everyone needs their own kind, you know? And so you have to kind of know the individual choices everybody has to make. And there's just so many choices. And you go some places like outside of California sometimes, or, you know, for some places, and they don't have all the choices you're used to. I mean, you go places and they don't have anything but regular milk. I mean, how primitive. You know, what about the 1%, the 2%, the non-fat, the lactose-free, the lactase-filled or whatever, you know, there's, you know, and then there's, you know, kefir, and there's all these different things you can get. It's amazing what you can get in California in terms of choices. The world has never seen a society that has as many choices as we have. No wonder we're depressed. I mean, who can sort through all of it? It's a lot. So this store called choices. Life is choices. We can call life choices. A series of choices you make. So there's a quote by the Buddha that goes, whatever is thought about and reflected on frequently becomes the inclination of the heart. Inclination of the mind. Heart and mind is the same word. Whatever you think about a lot becomes the disposition or the inclination where the mind wants to go, where the heart wants to go. I think this is a very, very important teaching. Because it points to that, again, that the choices we make is important. And how we live our lives, how we think, something so primary to us, even how I think, let alone how we speak, what we speak about, and how we behave, has consequences. And one of the consequences is it creates a certain disposition in our hearts, certain inclination in our hearts. If you spend a lot of time, you might have very good reasons to gripe. Very justified, and it's really very justified reasons why people have to hear your gripes. If you spend a lot of time doing that, there becomes kind of a leaning in the mind, a tendency towards it being easier to gripe in the future. That's what this quote is kind of saying. Or if you spend a lot of time being kind, it becomes a little bit easier for you. You're kind of leaning in that direction to be kind. So what we do doesn't just exist in and of itself at that moment, but it kind of puts a little spin on our hearts. It kind of nudges it in a certain kind of direction. And if you do something repeatedly, that leaning becomes more severe, stronger. So in the teachings of the Buddha, the instructions are, take some responsibility for the dispositions, how your heart is disposed. You don't have to take the heart's disposition, the heart's inclination, as a given. If you're born this way and this is the way it is, and it's going to be that way forever. But actually you can shape and change your disposition, your inclination, the tendency or the thoughts, the reactions, the way you tend to respond in different situations by living and choosing in the present wise ways of living or unwise ways, whatever way you want to go. And as I say often, if you don't take responsibility for your dispositions, for the inclinations of your heart, for the shape of your thoughts and your motivations, your intentions, your choices. There's a lot of people in society who are paid a lot of money to do it for you, to shape your mind for you. And there's people who are very good at that. And also, it isn't just other people wanting to influence you, but you know, there's a certain kind of tendency I've noticed that just being in certain cultures, in certain milieus, will shape or influence our mind in certain ways, create a certain disposition for us. And one kind of, it was kind of poignant kind of lesson for, and is for me, was that when I came to Palo Alto in 1990, I had a beat up old Toyota. And I was very content in my beat up old Toyota. And where I'd come from, and living in San Francisco, I was still actually in 1990 living in San Francisco, and lived there for a few more years. But came down here a lot to school and to teach. And up there, there were a lot of beat-up old cars. I didn't feel like I was unusual. I drove that car around for quite a while down here. And about 4 or 5 years, I noticed that I was more and more in Palo Alto. I started noticing that my car was one of the older ones in town. So that's an interesting observation. It's a reasonable observation to make. If you're observant, you notice things like that. But then I noticed that I started noticing other things came with that. Oh, I wonder. It doesn't feel, maybe people are judging me a little bit. Maybe they think I'm kind of like, not good enough, There's a lot of other people in Palo Alto have, most black people had a lot newer cars than I had, cars were 1 or 2 years old or whatever. And I'm a little bit the odd man out here having this old car. And, it would be good to have a good car, a big new car. If I had a newer car, it'd be good, to have it, And then I'd fit in more, or whatever, It was very, very subtle. I don't remember exactly the thoughts that went in my mind. But I could see myself starting to have these new car thoughts. And I was being influenced by that environment around me. And other environments would influence me in other ways about cars. So the dispositions that we, you know, it's kind of like a disposition or inclination that was being created in my mind. And the more I thought about it, the more I think about those and get caught by those, the more I'm likely to follow up on that and live with it. I met a man this weekend who, a lovely man, who, because of the how difficult financial difficulties in the province, I guess, of Vancouver or British Columbia, wasn't able to do the work in the hospital where he loves to work. And so he'd taken a job in a boating store. And he was okay, you know, sometimes, but there were a lot of really wealthy people who came in who bought, like, boats that were over $1 million boats. And they'd have these boats, you know, decked out, he said, with two bathrooms and DVDs in each little, you know, little room they had and all this different stuff. He said they were really kind of decked out with, you know, very opulent boats. And what amazed him was that people who had all this wealth and all these wealthy boats, all this stuff, would get bent out of shape because they didn't have something, little thing for the boat. They didn't have a DVD player for the bathroom, too, or whatever, you know, something. And they would get bent out of place. Or a friend of mine in Los Angeles, who is a psycho-economist. And he's what it is, he's a psychologist for wealthy people who suffer because of their money. This is kind of a niche market. And he told me about people, clients of his who had, you know, $50 million and were really worried that they didn't have enough money. And so, you know, they realized they had a problem, so they would, you know, go to him. So, you know, disposition of the mind, you know, it's so shapeable in the mind. And by the environment, by all kinds of conditions. But what's frequently thought about becomes an inclination of the heart. So this teaching about looking at the places we have choice also becomes looking at how we shape the inclination of the heart. We're kind of the default. What's the default way that your mind, your heart, responds to the world around you? Do you just accept the default as it is, or do you feel that actually you can change it? And Buddhism says you can. You might not be able to change it in big ways, or some fundamental things maybe you can't change, but I like this expression, inclination. You kind of incline it in one direction. Maybe all kinds of things arise, but you're inclining it in a certain kind of way. Maybe you're inclined to say no a lot. Maybe that's all. You develop the veto power. You know, all kinds of things bubble up in your mind, thoughts, ideas, and you see it and you say, wow, you know, I don't think I have to pick that up. I don't think I need to say that. And that becomes an inclination of the heart, the inclination to say no. Oh, no thank you. I don't need to spread rumors anymore. I don't think I will anymore. You might feel the inclination to have rumors, say rumors, but no. No thanks. And to develop that as a strength so that that kind of no feels like a relief rather than a burden. That kind of no frees the mind rather than puts a kind of limitation on it. Wouldn't that be great? Do you have some sense that a good no like that can free you rather than be a burden? I hope you do. So one choice that we make in practice is when not to exercise choice, when to kind of just get out of the way, when to just sit mindfully and just be mindful and present for how things are. And not try to change anything, just let it kind of be. And that's a very, very valid way of being, but it's also a choice. The choice is to kind of let go of all choice except the being present. And sometimes that is a really good thing to do. And other times, you want to exercise your choice in other ways, more actively and more clearly. Anyway, that's probably enough. I should exercise my veto power here. And so my encouragement for you this week is that you kind of look more carefully at the choices you make and see if you can be sensitive to choices you make that you haven't really realized that you've made, or you don't really think about. Maybe you can ask a friend to kind of point some out to you. You see, you just made a choice here? Oh, I guess I did. Do what you can to look at choices. And then, I don't know, and then see if you can start being discerning or curious about how operating in the realm of choices in a responsible way can make you feel lighter and happier and more joyful, more loving. And if you can't actually feel that way, at least you're kind of leaning in that direction. Leaning to becoming freer and happier and more joyful. So that's your homework. So now it's your turn. We have 10 minutes if you'd like to ask questions or comments or testimonials about choices, or reservations, protests. Yes?
What kind of card did you buy?
I bought a new car.
You did?
Yes. I bought a little Honda 2-door Civic. Oh, it was like a silver bullet. It was great. I felt so hot. Zipping through Palo Alto. I'll show them my little Civic. Yes?
May or may not relate to this talk, but I just to bring up that I was really deeply depressed and disgusted with all the, these abuse events that took place and not found me.
Or in the news.
In Iraq.
Yeah.
And found myself in a state where, you know, I wasn't feeling like a Buddhist at all. I knew compassion or the forgiveness. And I just wanted to. I guess I'm looking for some guidance. Where do I find compassion for these people?
So the question is that she said she was quite depressed about the stories coming out of Iraq of prisoners being abused, and where does she find her compassion? Where does she find her forgiveness? How does she work with the difficult feelings she's feeling, the depressive feelings she feels in reading this, that this happens? And that's a great question. And sometimes the place to start is with oneself. If you're feeling terribly depressed and angry and upset, I think having some forgiveness, some acceptance of yourself in that state is a very important place to begin, so that you're not beating yourself up or kind of making it worse for yourself for being that way. Sometimes being very accepting of how we're feeling is the beginning of knowing or finding how to relate to these in a wise way, and maybe finding how to massage it and work with it and explore it. Sometimes when we're really deeply troubled by what goes on in the world around us in ways that are debilitating to us, then sometimes the best thing to do is to turn around and bring the attention back to oneself, try to understand really well the fear or the anger that we're carrying. Because if we're really debilitated by it, probably the fear and anger we're feeling is not being very useful or helpful or even appropriate for the situation. I'm not going to say that it's inappropriate to have anger or fear, but if we're debilitated by it, then I suggest is to go inside. That's one place very important to do. Another important area in this kind of situation is it can be very depressing and very difficult if people feel like they have no power in this situation to do anything. So feeling helplessness and is very debilitating, can add to this. There's just terrible things going on, but I'm hopeless, helpless in dealing with it, or doing anything with it. And in some sense, that far away, we don't have that much we can do in distance. But it's very, very important that we feel that the greater the tragedy, the greater its impacts our psyche, our hearts, the more important I feel it is that we also have to do something in response to it. Find something to do, whether it's writing a letter to a senator or somewhere, or going to a protest, or you know, whatever it is, you know, whatever seems appropriate. It could be very small. It doesn't have to be even directly related to the particular incident. It could be inspired by that, but you know, I'm going to go, you know, work for an abuse hotline in this country, so that to help people here in this country, or send some money to some kind of people who work with victims of abuse or something. But to actually be able to act and feel like you're actually doing something in the direction of trying to deal with this thing that's had a big impact on you, I think it's very important, so we don't feel stuck in being helpless and the feelings that come from that. Rainbow.
I was going along with the gist of what you were discussing today, and it seems to me that is a lot of what the meditation aspect of the practice is about, is to not reinforce the habitual of responding, of reacting,
right,
to just drop that and not make that move any deeper, just to incline toward another way to respond.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's
a big
part of it, yeah. And having the ability to not respond is a really important part of this. So, you know, if the idea of making choices and taking responsibility seems a little bit difficult or premature, the first step to that in meditation, especially, but also outside, is learning not to respond first. To let go and just let it be, let things be before you don't have to act on it or respond or do anything. Just let it be for a while, and sometimes by letting things be, understand all kinds of understanding, intuitions, and things can arise that gives us more sense. But if we act right away, in the first choice that comes up, or the second, or whatever, sometimes that's, you know, premature. So learning the ability not to respond is a very important part of practice. And if it's often true in conversations, right, or in many situations in life, that a lot wonderful things can happen if we just pause a little bit. Yes.
I say that I've been obsessing over these reasons now too, and I think that we have to own that event that in a way that isn't, I don't know, necessarily what you're saying, because they did that in our meeting, and you know, we're having levity around you know, new cars and grocery stores and toys and stuff, but you know, right now in the world, people are doing things, these atrocious things, so that we can have all this stuff. And, I mean, we have to own that, like I said. We have to own this, this
I agree, completely. So this is the world of choice, also, is part of making choices is to understand really well the consequences of the choices we make. And the choices we make, the consequences don't just happen immediately in our psyche, don't just you know, are personal for our own hearts, but there are consequences that spill out beyond us. You know, what we choose to buy. You know, one of the things that frightens me about what's happening in many, many countries, but especially here in America, is this tremendous drive to have cheap goods. And so, you know, the kind of Walmartization of the world, where it's great, you know, in some ways it's nice to be able to buy things cheaply, you know, it's all kind, you know, there's certainly a nice aspect about that. But the consequence is that if you buy something at Walmart, then you're supporting a situation where people are not getting benefits, very good benefits, compared to what they used to have. And so there's kind of like you're kind of marginalizing more and more people in our society. So I went recently to buy a friend of mine a flashlight. He wanted a special kind of flashlight. So I went, took him to REI. And I thought, oh, you know, I probably could have gotten this flashlight cheaper. Maybe they had it at Target. And it's good, right, to buy things cheaper. But if I buy it at REI, I think I'm supporting that I'm paying extra money, but that money supports a healthier work environment, people who work there. So my choices have consequences that spill out. And so the question is, what are the externalities that we're willing to take into account? And so when things happen in our name abroad, after 9/11, there was a lot of Americans who said, how could this have happened? How could the world hate us so much back then? And many people had lived kind of an insular life, hadn't been aware of consequences and things that had been done in the name of America for decades, years, centuries. They thought that America was just all about the Peace Corps, sending good people abroad to help. Yes, I agree with you. So choices involve looking carefully at the wider situation, and then it gets complicated when you try to understand the wider situation. Yeah.
I find for me that it's important to understand the differences between my choice and other people's, particularly when it comes to the emotional responsibility, where if some bad event happens, I can feel guilty because I saw a choice somebody else made, and that's destructive for myself. So it's good to understand and be compassionate about the events that happen, but at the same time, not to be emotionally responsible for a choice.
Mm-hmm.
So that I can balance.
Yeah. So very, very well said. There's actually a meditation practice in Buddhism called equanimity practice, where you actually say a phrase. Other people make their own choices. I might wish that person all the best. But I'm not responsible for that person's choices. That person makes their own choices, and that's considered very kind of a wise form of equanimity, to realize and let people make their own. I don't know if let them, but realize other people make their own choices, and that you're not responsible for the choices they make. I'm trying to learn that with my 6-year-old. There's a kind of summary, tending to your dispositions, tending to your heart, and taking responsibility for it, and beginning to cultivate a heart that expresses generosity and love, compassion, peace, is one of the things the world most needs. And so it starts with you. So I hope that this wonderful pairing of mindfulness and choice is for your benefit and for the benefit of all. So thank you very much.